Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, an unusual program. First, we're going to begin with not the latest on health and nutrition, as we normally would, but rather an in-depth, original investigative report, a continuation of our ongoing series, challenging the so-called skeptic authorities, the people who will, more often than not, downplay or even denigrate those of us in the field of health, no matter what our background, no matter what the reality of our clinical experiences, our education, our scientific discoveries. They simply dismiss it, denigrate it, attack it. So then you would assume that they're right, right? The mainstream media, like the New York Times, has quoted them without challenge. Consumers Report uses their input as if it's as good as testing a car. But are they accurate? Our investigation brings a challenge to that. Hence the title of our original investigative report today, Wikipedia, A Web of Deception. Now, following this, this article is now posted on our website, Progressive Radio Network, and you can watch today's program by going to Progressive Radio Network Facebook. I'm asking you to look at the 145 references, scientific references from peer-reviewed literature that we base this report upon. I'm asking you to use reason and common sense. Why? Because for as long as I've been in the field of health, there have been those individuals who have never been challenged on the accuracy or veracity of their claims, never had to prove that what they were saying was true. And yet, now we're finding that they should have been challenged. We were told, in fact, one of my earliest debates in my career, the person said, oh, vitamins, you don't need them. All they do is create expensive urine. And that's what every single person would say. Oh, they're no good. They're of no value. But I had a different perspective. I looked at the actual scientific literature and found out that with vitamin E, you weren't seeing important, discoveries because it was being used at a very tiny dose, 15 units, 30 units. And yet when I did a major conference at the Waldorf Astoria back in the early 1970s, where I brought together the Shute brothers from Canada and others who were actually experts, or even the major discoverer of these nutrients, like Albert St. George, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering ascorbic acid, vitamin C, he was at the conference. Dr. Williams from Texas, who discovered several. Dr. Ellis, who was America's leading authority on vitamin B6. They all had a lot of science behind them, but it was at higher dosages. The Shute brothers were able to reverse heart disease and gangrene at 1,000 to 2,000 units, and they had over 33,000 patients that they had worked with. No other doctor in America had anywhere near that, nor had anyone known about vitamin E working at high doses. So that led me to be able to look for the evidence, both in clinical experience and in the scientific literature. So imagine this. Just imagine for a moment that you're a person who has been told by someone, it might be a nurse, a doctor, a dentist, a dietitian, a nutritionist, a health counselor, or even a friend, that maybe you should test to see whether or not you're suffering from a vitamin deficiency, like vitamin D3, and that maybe you could benefit if you've been on a SAD diet, the standard American diet, by properly and intelligently supplementing a diet. And so you go to Wikipedia, and they tell you that, well, you really don't need to. In fact, they'll tell you how not only do you not need to, but there's really no proof that they're going to do any good. Once again, why take something when it's a waste of money? And for a lot of people, their journey could end right there. So we decided to take it a step further. We decided that the only way to properly and intelligently resolve this issue, do you need supplements or not, is to look at the hundreds of thousands of studies in peer-reviewed literature done at major institutions that are published in the government's official database, PubMed, and the Library of Medicine, and looking at studies that have been released through the National Academy of Sciences. So we're using the highest standards of accountability and credibility and scientific veracity. So then we ask, what are they using? Their opinion? Here is our report, and hopefully this will be used by everyone in this audience to share. I'm asking you to download the article and share it. Take this program and share it so that we can bring some objectivity and balance to what has been a one-sided and extremely biased approach to America's health needs. Wikipedia wants us to believe the entries in its encyclopedia are truthful, fair, and balanced. However, a comprehensive analysis of its nutritional articles reveals a plethora of factual inconsistencies and a clear and present bias against the very idea of nutritional supplementation. Even though almost every nutrient page admits most Americans don't consume the RDA of that particular vitamin or mineral, the page's editors still categorically discourage supplementation. Wikipedia's main article on vitamins declares that supplementation, quote, are thought to be of little value to healthy people, end quote, adding, quote, no clear justification exists for recommending supplementation for preventing many diseases, end quote. With vitamin D, so much so that, quote, further research of similar design is unneeded in these areas, unquote. Now that certainly sounds to me as final. That's it. You've heard the truth. Absolute. Irrefutable. It's Wikipedia. Well, not so fast. Wikipedia would have you believe the science is 100% settled on nutritional supplements. But what are their qualifications for making such declarations? Attempts by qualified professionals with over 40 years of experience in the nutritional field to edit these articles to reflect accurate information are merely changed back within minutes in accordance to the beliefs, not science, of the core group of skeptics who exercise an iron grip on Wikipedia's health and nutrition pages. Editors whose qualifications, to my personal view, are lacking or non-existent, are nevertheless given free rein to lead readers astray who might otherwise find information beneficial in their search for better health. A thorough study of thousands of scientific articles and peer-reviewed literature suggests that the skeptics controlling the flow of information aren't telling us everything we need to know, whether about the negative effects of consuming too little or the benefits of supplementing with these nutrients. Wikipedia and its co-founder, Jimmy Wales, have much to answer for, in my opinion, and should be held accountable. Their insistence on replacing the truth with their inaccurate, scientifically reductionist skepticism is contributing, in my opinion, to global ignorance on health issues. But I want you to know that these are not my beliefs or feelings. I will support everything that I'm about to say. And I'm going to share with you just some facts you won't find in Wikipedia's entries for essential vitamins and minerals, randomly selected from research scientific papers whose conclusions contradict those of Wikipedia, and they're consistent in their contradictions. And I also want to acknowledge the good work of Helen Meniski, who worked on this particular report. So I'm only taking a mere sample of the literature, but there are several hundred thousand articles you could read for yourself, and I've listed some of them in the footnotes. For example, vitamin A. the National Institutes of Health's global database of peer-reviewed medical literature, PubMed, turns up 52,337 articles on vitamin A. A sampling of those articles indicates a wealth of beneficial effects associated with this micronutrient. The journal Nutrients, a major peer-reviewed journal, discusses the positive effects of vitamin A on the immune system, extending to reduce mortality associated with diarrhea, measles, and meningitis, and other illnesses endemic to third world populations. The Journal of Molecular Neuroscience details multiple pathways of action on vitamin A for treating multiple sclerosis. The British journal The Lancet study demonstrates reduced incidence of malaria among children treated with vitamin A supplementation in Papua New Guinea. Vitamin A also has been shown by the literature to protect against night blindness, protect against age-related macular degeneration, aids in bone and tooth development, and has a protective effect against squamous cell carcinoma. Vitamin B1, also known as thiamine. PubMed lists 16,004 articles on the effects of thiamine. The Archives of Nutrition discusses thiamine's role in protecting against dementia, along with the other B vitamins, in conjunction with vitamin C and vitamin E. The journal Cardiovascular Drugs and Therapy recommends thiamine supplementation to improve outcomes in patients with heart failure. A study in Congestive Heart Failure Journal links thiamine to improvements in cardiac function, weight loss, urine output, and the symptoms of heart failure. The journal Case Reports Neurological Medicine found a strong link between thiamine supplementation and improvements in cluster headaches. Thiamine also, according to the scientific literature on PubMed, plays a central role in the production of RNA and DNA, improves cognitive function in individuals with Alzheimer's, reduces cell proliferation in breast cancer, and protects against pulmonary hypertension. I'm merely giving you a sample, and yet the skeptics would say, you don't need it. Really? So if my father and mother had dementia or heart disease, or my sister or mother, daughter had breast cancer, I would not be using this because I would trust your judgment? Where's the media? Where are the science editors? Where are the journalists? Where are the people at Consumer Reports? Where are the editors of the New York Times? If we can find this information, why can't you, with your unlimited resources? But let's continue. Let's look at vitamin B2, riboflavin. PubMed lists 17,529 articles concerning the effects of riboflavin. The substance has been shown by the proponents of the medical literature to have many health benefits. The publication Headache analyzes riboflavin's actions in modulating mitochondrial metabolic abnormalities, alleviating migraine symptoms, and pointing towards classification of migraine as a mitochondrial disorder. The journal, and mind you, I'm only citing peer-reviewed journals, The Electrophoresis demonstrates riboflavin's amelioration of muscle weakness linked to dysfunctional mitochondrial metabolism. And the journal Aging evaluated riboflavin's potential in cancer therapy with PDI, which blocks mitochondrial respiration without permanently damaging the cells. But also, riboflavin plays an integral role in cellular respiration metabolism, relieves oxidative stress and insulin resistance in diabetes, protects against neurodegenerative disease and cardiovascular disease, protects against anemia and thyroid dysfunction. Then we have vitamin B3, also called niacin. Niacin appears in PubMed literature in 13,061 articles. A sampling of this research reveals widespread clinical benefits stemming from this nutrient. The journal Biomedical Pharmacology outlined the therapeutic benefits of niacin supplementation in alleviating oxidative stress and insulin resistance and diabetes. The International Journal of Tryptophan research outlines the role of niacin as in protecting neurons from traumatic injury, stroke, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's disease. The journal Nutrients details the use of high-dose niacin supplementation to successfully treat bipolar disorder. But by the way, the scientific literature also shows niacin protects against brain injury during cardiac arrest. increases insulin sensitivity and moderates negative effects of a high-fat diet, maintains genetic stability and repairs DNA, alleviates psychotic symptoms in schizophrenia. Vitamin B5, called pantothenic acid. Ever the naysayer, Wikipedia says, quote, although pantothenic acid supplementation is under preliminary research for a variety of human diseases, there is insufficient evidence to date that it has any effect, end quote. All right. So if I were to read that, why go further? Why try it? However, we looked at the 3,347 articles actually published on PubMed, and the abundance of evidence is that it affects numerous precursors, and in fact, it's a precursor of vitamin A, a biomolecular involvement in over 70 enzymatic pathways. The International Journal of Vitamin and Nutritional Research reveals that pantothenic acid, as calcium D-pantothenate, improves healing and flesh wounds. The journal Vascular Health and Risk Management cites pantothenic acid effectiveness in reducing cholesterol levels and other cardiovascular risk markers. The Expert Review of Clinical Pharmacology Journal describes the protective effect of pantothenic acid against valproic acid-induced hepatic toxicity linked with increased oxidative stress. Plus, the scientific literature shows that pantothenic acid plays a crucial role in the metabolism of fats and carbohydrates, is integral to protein synthesis and amino acid catabolism, and protects against atherosclerosis and ameliorates oxidative stress and radiation damage. Vitamin B6, also called pyridoxine. They mentioned 9,893 articles on PubMed, and it has numerous beneficial effects across human cellular systems. The journal Cellular Molecular Biology illuminates vitamin B6's protective effects against Alzheimer's disease, citing the vitamin's antioxidant property as the active mechanism. The journal Anti-Cancer Research shows vitamin B6's potential role in treating malignant melanoma. Food chemistry toxicology demonstrates B6's protective effect against a hepatotoxicity enacted through suppression of oxidative stress and induction of antioxidant enzymes. Plus, it's an essential component of amino acids, carbohydrates, and lipids. It relieves morning sickness in pregnant women. It plays a role in neurotransmitter synthesis and hemoglobin formation. It protects against seizures, migraines, chronic pain, and depression. Vitamin B7 is biotin. Quote, biotin is often recommended as a dietary supplement for strengthening hair and nails, though scientific data supporting these outcomes are weak. So says Wikipedia. Not quite. Biotin is referenced 31,208 articles on PubMed, which show systemic benefits extending far beyond hair and nails. The journal Cutis describes a marked improvement in nail health among subjects taking biotin supplement. The Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry outlines biotin's potential in treating diabetes, hyperglycemia, hyperlipidemia based upon its improvement in glucose tolerance and promotion of glucose and lipid homeostasis. Multiple Sclerosis Journal reveals that high-dose biotin supplementation produces sustained reversal of multiple sclerosis. Oh, and to throw in a little extra in the thousands of studies, it influences the mediation of gene expression. It plays a key role in cell metabolism and growth and differentiation. It shows potential as a gene-based cancer therapy and delivery system. It regulates immunological and inflammatory functions. Would I know that from Wikipedia? No. Vitamin B9, also known as folate. PubMed lists only 56,178 studies that mentions folate. The benefits of folate are so well known that over 50 countries fortify certain foods with the nutrient to ensure adequate consumption by their populations. The American Journal of Clinical Nutrition reveals a decreased breast cancer risk associated with higher folate intake in postmenopausal women. The Journal of Gastroenterology and Hepatology similarly finds a decreased risk of esophageal and pancreatic cancers associated with folate consumption. The Journal of Biotechnic and Histochemistry shows that folic acid supplementation mitigates the toxic effects of biphenyl A in testes. It also has been shown to prevent neurotube defects in utero when taken during early pregnancy, decreases the risk of stroke, decreases the risk of cardiovascular disease, promotes wound healing, is integral to cell division and growth, particularly during infancy and pregnancy. Not bad for what it does. Who's telling us this? Vitamin B12. PubMed lists 30,510 studies mentioning vitamin B12. Supplementation is mandated in vegans and vegetarians because B12 is only found in animal foods or in fermented foods. Nevertheless, the literature is full of side benefits to such supplementation. Example, the Journal of Neurological Sciences shows that B12 supplementation has a protective effect against multiple sclerosis progression. The journal Maternal and Child Health Journal finds that maternal vitamin B12 supplementation leads to a higher expressive language scores in children at 30 months. The journal Diabetes Care suggests B12 supplementation improved outcomes for elderly diabetic individuals presenting with neuropathy and positive oxidative stress as the culprit in declining B12 levels. But not just that. B12 also plays a central role in myelin formation, protects against pernicious anemia and associated psychiatric symptoms, reduces oxidative stress and lessens its negative effects on the nervous system, protects against Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. That alone, just protecting against Alzheimer's and vascular dementia, should be enough to encourage everyone over the age of 50 to be making sure they have it every day. But evidently, Wikipedia is not impressed. Vitamin C. Weren't we told we really don't need more than what you're getting in your diet? Okay, fair enough argument. Now, test it. One of the things that I learned as a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology over 33 years and doing more nutritional research than anyone in the history of the Institute, including 165 completely full studies, was that never trust the outcome until you've deconstructed your arguments. Meaning, you prove something, now disprove it. And only when you and others cannot disprove it can you trust that maybe you have something important. So when I was speaking there at the Institute at night when I was doing my research with Linus Pauling, Albert Sengorgi, and dozens of outstanding scientists, I would ask them a simple question. How much do you take? And the individuals you know and have suggested this, what are the outcomes? Well, there was one physician from California, a board-certified, regular, mainstream Orthodox physician who heard that I was helping people who were HIV-infected with full-blown AIDS at the Institute of Applied Biology's research and then applied through the patient care at the Tri-State Healing Center with a team of medical doctors and nurses. I was offering people very high doses of vitamin C, as high as 200,000 milligrams. And lo and behold, not a single patient died. 1,200 patients. You wouldn't have known that, except for the African-American community that's about a light years ahead of the Caucasian community and far more open, far more honest, far more grace with integrity when it comes to reporting on good work done. Bill Tatum, Amsterdam News, reported on it. Tony Brown of Tony Brown's Journal and PBS reported on it. Stokely Carmichael, a friend, was there regularly and reported. Arthur Ashe, the African-American tennis great, was there. All kinds of people were there. You'd never know it, based upon mainstream science, that we were getting results that no drug before or since has ever gotten, reversing full-blown AIDS in eight people, 100%, holding a press conference. The African-American governor of New York was there. David Patterson, a group of scientists was there. Not a single member of the AIDS gay community nor the mainstream media were there. Why? What were they afraid of? And how do you think that research, those actual 1,200 long-term survivors using natural therapies, including high-dose vitamin C, how would they have reported this? That it was all an illusion? that it was quackery, that it was so pseudoscience. Well, try telling someone who has fought with AIDS and HIV infection, who's alive today to show it and has all their blood work up, and tell them, yeah, it was just all an illusion. No, your game is up. And shame on the mainstream media for protecting the people who do not have real science and any results on their side. But they sure do have disdain for those of us who do. So guess how many reports are on vitamin C, the so-called nutrient that's of little benefit. We get enough in an orange. Really? How much is in an orange? Oh, I forgot, you're not a registered dietitian. I am. But you would be a clinical nutrition with a degree in clinical. No, you're not. We have a PhD in human nutrition and public health science. No, you don't. You've worked with 70,000 people. No, you haven't. You've published in the science. You've done clinical. None. Well, then pray tell, what exactly, outside of hubris, arrogance, conceit, and narcissism, allows you the privilege of being the sole arbiter of truth on matters that you have never personally experienced? I'm just curious. It's a question, not a rhetorical statement. Because when I looked in PubMed, I found 65,500 articles. Let me repeat that. 65,500 articles on vitamin C on PubMed. Picking out just a few reveals a wide range of health benefits associated with the substance, the journal Nutrients. Oh, and by the way, that Dr. Robert Cathcart was the man who came one night to the Tri-State Healing Center, but he had also come by quietly and sat on two nights looking with a whole group of people were there one night when I was talking about vitamin C and doing some vitamin C studies. And he said, how much vitamin C would a person who has Kaposi's sarcoma have to take in order to help that person? I said, I would start at 50,000 milligrams and go up. He went back to California, having come over to the Institute, then to the Tri-State Healing Center, interviewed over 100 persons with full-blown AIDS, went back to California, and guess what? Became the leading number one physician in the entire state of California of treating people with Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis-screening pneumonia, the one and two cause of death in people with AIDS-defining illnesses, NARC, and had more success than anyone in the history of the United States treating those two. Mainstream, did you ever hear a word about him or that work? Not a word. So here the journal Nutrients discusses the well-known role of vitamin C supplementation in preventing and lessening the duration of the common cold, which Wikipedia denies. The European Journal of Cell Biology discusses vitamin C as L-scorbate cancer-fighting properties, specifically in colorectal cancer. Wikipedia categorically denies any anti-cancer effects in the nutrient, dismissing the plethora of scientific studies in the literature as, quote, observational and uncontrolled studies. CNS Neuroscience Journal and Therapeutics analyzes vitamin C's antioxidant action in the central nervous system and how these processes inhibit the onset of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. But vitamin C also plays a central role in immune system function, prevents scurvy, indicates promise as a non-toxic cancer treatment, facilitates iron absorption. Vitamin D, one of the most important nutrients that we could ever take and that a lot of Americans are deficient in, especially children and senior citizens. PubMed has 77,269 articles on vitamin D, making it the most studied vitamin. Just a glimpse at the literature shows numerous benefits associated with this micronutrient. I'll give you an example. The American Journal of Public Health surveys decades of studies revealing a strong correlation between vitamin D and its metabolites and reduced risk of decreased mortality, that means death, from colorectal cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and ovarian cancers. So let's just put this in perspective. Vitamin D can keep a person with cancer of the breast, of the prostate, of the colon, and ovarian cancers alive longer. Shouldn't we then be telling people, take the vitamin D if you have these cancers? Why aren't oncologists aware of this? It's in their own literature. It's there. The British Journal of Psychiatry discusses the positive effects of vitamin D supplementation on depressed patients. The Journal of Nutritional Neuroscience illustrates the link between low serum levels of vitamin D and autism spectrum disorder, then demonstrates that vitamin D supplementation leads to improvement in behavioral and language metrics in children with autism spectrum disorder. Vitamin D also protects against development of multiple sclerosis and ameliorates symptoms of patients with MS. It strengthens bones and protects against osteoporosis and osteomalacia. It protects against development of type 1 diabetes, increases insulin sensitivity in type 2 diabetes, and improves cardiac function post-myocardial infarction, which means every person that's had a heart attack should be using vitamin D3. Then we come to vitamin E. And remember I said at the beginning of this discussion that I got together the world's leading developers or therapeutic uses of vitamins, and the Shoup brothers had over 33,000 patients that had worked with vitamin D, and they had slides and they had monographs showing all these. Well, here's what Wikipedia says about vitamin E. Quote, population studies suggest that people who consume foods with more vitamin E or choose on their own to consume a vitamin D Eve diet supplement had lower incidence of cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia, and other diseases, but placebo-controlled clinical trials could not always replicate these findings, end quote. That's a backhanded slap. That's typical of their approach. Never satisfied with anything less than perfect replication, the skeptic editors overlooked 41,453 studies referencing vitamin E in PubMed on their elusive quest for the perfect clinical trial. The peer-reviewed journal Nutrients is a comprehensive survey of studies on the subject and points to the beneficial effects of vitamin E on Alzheimer's disease, dementia, suggesting the mechanism of action extends beyond its antioxidant capacity to its role in signaling, membrane fluidity, and gene regulation. The International Journal of Vitamin and Nutrition Research discusses neuroprotective capabilities of vitamin E against glutamate cytotoxic reactions and neurological death of cells. The journal Atherosclerosis reveals that vitamin E supplementation is effective in reducing death and atherosclerosis only when subject to consuming low-fat and low-cholesterol diets. And vitamin E also regulates enzyme activity and gene expression, shows promise as tocotrienol as a non-toxic anti-cancer treatment, lowers your cholesterol, protects against neurodegeneration. Now, I'm just going to do a couple more. You can read the rest of them on the site. Vitamin K, 24,421 studies on PubMed. But none of those studies are good enough for Wikipedia, which states, quote, vitamin K has been promoted in supplemental form with claims it can slow tumor growth. However, no good medical evidence supports such claims, end quote. We found, however, by carefully reading the articles, the Archives of Physiology and Biochemistry shows beneficial effects on high-dose vitamin K in combination with calcium in treating liver cancer. Couldn't find it, skeptics? It's there. And also, the Paul Merrick-Lekarski recommends a constant concentration of vitamin K in the diet to prevent complications arising from continued dosage of a hydroxycoumarin derivative. The medical journal Biofactors details the role of vitamin K in synthesizing a class of structural lipids that, in addition to shaping brain cell membranes, also plays a significant part in proliferation, differentiation, and cell-to-cell interactions and senescence. It also is needed to synthesize proteins involved in blood clotting. It plays a role in cognition and behavior. It slows the development of soft tissue calcification and uremia, and it prevents vascular calcification. And for calcium, Wikipedia calls calcium supplementation, quote, controversial, end quote. What exactly is controversial about it, but admits that since 2010, the FDA has permitted the health claims that calcium and vitamin D supplements together protect against osteoporosis. Qualified health claims regarding minerals' effectiveness in reducing the risk of colon cancer, and hypertension are also permitted. We found 563,919 results for calcium and the nutrient in ubiquitous in the body processes on PubMed. The European Journal of Nutrition confirms calcium's effectiveness in improving bone mineral density in teenage girls. Public Health Nutrition adds that in addition to its preventative benefits against the disease, calcium reduced the rate of bone loss in patients who already had osteoporosis. And the New England Journal of Medicine finds calcium supplementation reduced the risk of recurrent colorectal adenomas. Calcium also plays a central role in blood cell synthesis, protects against stroke, especially in conjunction with magnesium and potassium, contributes to bone growth and development, and lowers blood cholesterol. Wow. And copper is mentioned in 118,869 studies on PubMed. Metalomics discusses copper's role in treating cancer as an alternative to platinum-based chemotherapy drugs. The journal Nutricum Hospitalarium finds a significant protective role of copper against cognitive and physical disabilities in the elderly, and drug and chemical toxicity shows the protective antioxidant effects of copper in combination with nicotinate on the kidneys in the presence of glycerol. It protects against anemia, plays a role in the neurotransmitter synthesis, shows strong potential in chelation treatment. And then I found iodine with 112,000 studies, iron with 281,000 studies, magnesium with 102,000 studies on PubMed. And I'm not even going through what they all do. You can now find those for yourself since I've published the article. Potassium with 251,138 studies on PubMed. And then we have all the rest of the important studies. So all told, you're looking at over 1 million studies. Wow. And we would be led to believe that, well, there really are no studies. There are. We found them. We read them. We have them. I published with Helen an article on this. It's posted now. Now it's time for all the people all over the world who listen and watch this program, educate yourself. Educate yourself first to the benefit of proper and intelligent supplementation. My suggestion is to always have someone who is certified and qualified in the field, a medical doctor, a dentist, a holistic nurse, a dietitian, a naturopath, board certified, a health counselor who has proper accreditation, and let them help you where you might be deficient or benefit from proper supplementation. It's not good to do anything unless you're doing it properly. We're going to take a break and come back, and we're going to have our guests, but just a heads up for tomorrow. I played a video clip the other day of a very popular and very articulate and very intelligent person who has gone from the left to the right. And I challenged her in a polite way that on global warming, she is simply wrong on all of her facts. And I'm pretty sure that many of her facts come from the talking points that everyone on the right is most are climate change denialist. So I simply ask her, please have the integrity to deconstruct your own arguments. And I gave her professors, I gave her citations where she could actually quantitatively change her opinion if she chose to. Tomorrow, I will play another clip of hers, and then I'm going to offer her a challenge, but I'm also going to offer all the people who voted for Hillary Clinton a challenge, and the people who voted for Donald Trump a challenge. Deconstruct your views, and I'm going to give you some progressive programs that all of you, including Candace Owen, should read, educate yourself about if you want to see us have a happier, healthier, and more peaceful world in the future. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only night we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We'll be posting another article, have a brand new article next week, and then another article after that. For all these years and decades, I've chosen to focus only upon solutions to problems and not pay attention to those who would backstab, who would attack, malign, and slander. But it's not about me, because I don't take it personally. It is about what happens when people who could benefit from this information are denied it because the people are so biased, trying to educate the public and feels that they have no expertise that I can find. They have not counseled, and they have not the clinical experience that thousands of people who have used healthy diets, lifestyle, de-stressing techniques, exercise, and these people are never given a form. And the people who don't do any of the above are the so-called leaders of that. So now we're challenging them. My guest now is a person that has done a lot of challenging in the past on the subject of how much we're influenced by our upbringing and by our earlier life conditioning and by the conditioning of our parents and grandparents, the epigenetics. He is Professor Bruce Lipton, an outstanding author, a person who is always an innovator, and he's here today to take us to a different level in understanding the power of the past in shaping our present and the future and how we can change that. Nice to have you with us today, Bruce.
I am so happy to be here, and I so appreciate everything you're doing, because knowledge is power, and there's been a great lack of knowledge offered from the top. And so everything you're doing, for me, is wonderful. Thank you, Gary.
Before we go into some of the body-mind concepts, let's understand that the term body-mind has entered our popular vocabulary, and we hear it being used increasingly in medicine and spirituality and even by those speaking of ecology and human nature interactions. And over the decades, the expression body-mind has increasingly entered our everyday usage. We use this term not only in spiritual disciplines involving meditation, but also in yoga, but also in psychosomatic medicine, in body psychotherapy, and an area I'm particularly interested in, psychoneuroimmunology, the interaction between our brain's psychology processes and our nervous and immune systems. And like any word that gets overused and enters the popular parlance of society, it gradually becomes rather meaningless. And I think the overuse and abuse of the word empowerment is a good example. So when we consider the body-mind relationship from that of psychoneuroimmunology, how does this change our understanding of the body-mind concept? And what would you define as being the body-mind self from this perspective? The forum is yours.
Well, the first thing is this. We've been programmed to believe that genes turn on and off, and in that process are self-actualizing, controlling their own development. This is a completely false statement. There is no gene that turns on and off. A gene is a blueprint to make a protein, which is the building block of the body, and there are 100,000 different proteins. So basically, these are blueprints to create the protein. And why it's relevant to emphasize blueprint is, for example, you go into an architect's office and she's working on a blueprint, and you ask her, is your blueprint on or off? And she'd look at you like you're crazy. There is no on and off. A blueprint doesn't have on and off. It's just a piece of message of how to make a protein. Well, the relevance then is then when we have been programmed to believe that genes turn on and off, that's a programming of victimization. Meaning, as far as we know, we didn't pick the genes we came with, and if you don't like the characteristics you have, you can't change the genes. And apparently the genes were supposedly turning on and off, and if you put all that together, it says your life is not under your control. It's sort of like pre-programmed at the moment of conception. A lot of people believe that, like, oh, there's cancer running in my family. I got a cancer gene. I'm going to get cancer because of the gene. Well, this is a completely false statement. First of all, there's not even a gene that causes cancer. There's no gene that causes cancer, period. And so what we have to do is say, well, wait, if genes are not turning off on and off by themselves, then what controls genes? The answer is the environment in which the cells live. Now, in my studies years ago, I revealed that genetically identical cells in three Petri dishes, but I fed them three different versions of culture medium because I synthesized culture medium. I created three slightly different versions. And in one dish, the cells form muscle. In another dish, the cells form bone. In a third dish, the cells form fat cells. The point is very simple. Their cells were genetically identical. The fate of the cell was not determined by the genes, but by the environment in which they're in. Now, the connection here is I grow them in culture medium, and I say, well, what is culture medium? It's the laboratory version of blood. So all of a sudden it says this, the chemistry of your blood is what is controlling genes. And then the next level is, yeah, but then what controls the chemistry of your blood? And I go, the brain controls the chemistry, determining which factors are hormones, emotional chemicals, growth factors, or whatever is in the blood, because when the blood goes to the cell, those factors control genetics. So now the next step says, okay, the brain is the chemist that makes the culture medium that has the signals that control genes. And then the big question comes that, yeah, but what determines the chemistry of the blood? And that is the most exciting part because it's the mind, the psychology. If you open your eyes and you see someone you love, the brain translates the mind's picture of love into chemistry, such as dopamine for pleasure, vasopressin makes you more attractive to your partner, oxytocin bonds you with the love, growth hormone is released when people are in love, the vision of love. And I go, oh, wow. So when you see people in love and they say, oh, see how they glow and see how healthy they are, I say, that's not an accident. That is a consequence of the chemistry of love being introduced into the blood, which then affects the cells. And then in contrast, if you open your eyes and you see something that scares you, the chemistry I just mentioned that was promoting health, that's not released by the brain in a picture of fear. What's released are stress hormones and inflammatory agents that affect the immune system. And I say, oh my goodness. So when you change your vision from love to fear, you change the entire chemistry of the blood. But the blood is what is controlling genes. So there's a very simple and profoundly important bottom line that you've been emphasizing, Gary, and that is simply this. The picture in your mind that you hold, whether it's true or false, that doesn't make any difference because the cells don't get to determine if your mind's picture is right or not. The cells just respond to the mind. And so two people in the exact same environment responding to the exact same inputs from that environment can have totally different consequences based on how they perceive that environment, how they interpret that environment. And I go, perception, interpretation, well, that's mind. So the idea of mind-body, which was for a long time like a New Agey thing, it's like, it's not New Agey, it's a direct connection. The mind has a picture, the brain translates the picture into chemistry that complements that picture, and then that chemistry goes into the body and creates a cellular environment that is a complement of the picture. And I say, then what's the relevance? And the answer is this, change your mind and you change your body. Change your vision, what you see about life, and you change your genetics. And all of a sudden I say, why is that important? And the answer is simple. The old story almost everybody's been programmed with, which is called genetic determinism. Genes control your life, as I said, make us victims. If I believe I have a cancer gene, then I can anticipate getting a cancer. But now here's the issue. The genes are not controlled by themselves. They're controlled by the environment and your perception and your interpretation. And all of a sudden I say, oh, my goodness, and two people standing next to each other in the exact same environment can have totally different interpretation of what they see and then have two totally different biological, physiological responses. And I say, why is it relevant? I'm the one that can change my mind. And if I change my mind, I change my chemistry, and it's the chemistry that controls the genes. So all of a sudden it says, mind-body, that is the hierarchy. That is the biology. That's not a New Age thing. That's a direct chemical translation. And then I say, so why is it important? Because we are so powerful when you recognize this, because I can say, well, I can change my mind. I go, and the moment you change your mind, you can change your genetic activity. And then we go from victim to mastery. But people can't go there if they have no understanding that their mind is the exact source of the chemistry that controls genes. And when that becomes available and supported, then people will be empowered. And the issue is very simply this. It's been estimated by the American Psychological Association that up to 90% of doctor visits are totally due to stress. And I go, well, why is that relevant? Because stress is induced by the mind. The mind perceives stress, and the body releases stress chemicals that interfere with the growth in the immune system. Of course, it leads to illness. And the issue is, why is this so important? If 90% is due to stress, and stress is an inside job that I can change myself, then why would I need the pharmaceutical industry? And all of a sudden, you see why the hold, the death grip on knowledge by the pharmaceutical industry is their last gasp effort to hold on to their world, because of a simple fact, Gary, and you've been talking about it, but I'll just emphasize it quickly, and that is this. If a drug works, it works because you have a receptor on a cell, a protein receptor, that will respond to that drug. And I go, oh, well, if I take a drug and it works, I have a receptor, then the first thing is this. If I already have the receptor in my body before the pharmaceutical company created the drug, then what was that receptor responding to? And the answer was, every drug that the pharmaceutical company makes is an equivalent of a natural drug made by our biology. In other words, a drug can't work if we don't have a natural equivalent of that drug already. And then I say, why is that important? I say, well, is that drug going to be released into your body naturally without you going to the pharmaceutical company? I go, well, it depends on what you're trying to create with your mind. If it's a picture of health and harmony and love, then all the wonderful chemicals will come out and manifest a body that is a direct complement of that. And that's what we talked about. Like, you can see people when they're in love because they're so healthy. It's not an accident. It's a chemical consequence. And then you can see people that are not doing well when they live in fear and concern about their vitality or whatever threats, because the chemistry of that image is a chemistry that shuts down the growth in the immune system. A matter of fact, a very important fact, stress hormones shut down the immune system. And I say, why would it do that? And the answer is this. If you're running from a saber-toothed tiger under stress and you need to get away, you want all the energy possible. So when stress hormones are released in the vision of that tiger chasing you, the function of the stress hormones is to shut off all functions not associated with escaping. And I say, well, what functions are those? And I say, well, growth and maintenance of the body. I mean, why would you fund energy into growth and maintenance of the body when you could use that energy to run away from the tiger? And the same applies to the immune system. This is the biggest issue. When stress is in the body, the stress hormones shut off the immune system to conserve energy so you can run away from the tiger. And I say, well, why? And I said, well, you know how much energy the immune system uses? Just imagine when you've been sick, you didn't even have energy to get out of bed. And the idea, so let's say I have a bacterial infection and I'm being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, where do you want to allocate the energy? It's like, the heck with the infection. I mean, if the tiger catches you, the infection's not a problem at all. But the idea is, stress hormones will shut down the immune system to conserve the energy to use to run away from the tiger. And in evolution, that was the only thing we had to worry about was the tiger. And if the tiger showed up and you escaped 10 minutes later, there's no more threat. And then you go back to normal health again. So stress responses evolutionarily were designed for short, intermediate bursts of activity, during which time you repress functions not associated with running away, such as growth or the immune system. But once you escape the tiger, then everything's back online. I go, that's great, except in today's world, the stress factor is 24/7, 365. human biology was never designed to be in this stress, because the chemicals released by the brain in stress redirect the energy from maintenance and health of the body to escape. And if you prolong that stress, it's inevitable. The only consequence is sickness and death. And it's really interesting, because the effect of stress hormones on the immune system is so great that when doctors want to transplant an organ from patient A to patient B, and they don't want patient B's immune system to immediately reject the organ, they give the patient stress hormones before the transplant, because the stress hormones will inhibit that immune system and prevent the immediate rejection of the graft. So, I mean, it's used therapeutically to shut off the immune system. What about everyday life? I go, it's the same function. So where's all the illness coming from? Not from the genes. It's really coming from how we are dealing with the environment around us. And this is why it becomes so important, because this knowledge is empowering. And that word empower, I know you mentioned, but empowering meaning this: I'm not a victim of my genes. I'm a victim of my mind, my consciousness, my programming. And we have collectively all been programmed to be disempowered. And that engages
Bruce, we're going to lose our stations in a moment here. Let us continue this for a longer discussion. Let my producer, Richard Gale, know when you're going to be available for an hour, because this deserves an hour. I want to get into Freud and his concepts. I want to talk about Darwin versus Freud and behaviors developed that persist and what we can do to change them. There's so much to discuss, so let's leave it there until our next meeting, all right?
I so appreciate that opportunity. Thank you, Gary, and I just want people to understand how truly powerful they are when they get out of the program that they're victims.
I agree. Professor Bruce Lipton, L-I-P-T-O-N, and if you're not familiar with his book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter Miracles, he has a new edition out, and he's also the author of The Honeymoon Effect, and we look forward to our next discussion with him, which will be an in-depth discussion. But we're out of time now, and I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.